When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 82. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am going all European and heading over to Brussels to talk to the Director of Public Affairs of the European Crop Protection Association, Graham Taylor. Graham, how are you?
I'm good, Will. Thanks very much for having me on.
That's all right. It's really good to speak to you again after meeting you in Brussels a few months back.
Yeah, not in a kitchen this time.
No. Probably fortunate for me. It's you who's the cooking expert, not me. I've probably torn you away from training because you are crazy enough to be doing a half Ironman this weekend, or are you currently carb loading?
Yeah, I'm doing some serious carb loading. I'm sitting in front of a pretty massive piece of cake right now. So I'm enjoying the opportunity to eat as much of that this week as I can.
Okay, more on that later. So, Graham, have you heard of the AFTP, the Agri-Food Training Partnership?
I can't say I have.
Well, I will tell you about it. It is a partnership between six leading UK universities and the bridge between industry and academia, translating cutting-edge academic research into applied industry expertise. Starting this month, listeners could be doing online part-time courses in subjects as interesting and diverse as grassland systems, ruminant health and welfare, ruminant nutrition, agro-ecosystem services, soil management, or water and agriculture. You will know just how important and relevant they are. You can find all these courses on www.aftp.co.uk/podcast. And there is currently a huge 25% off the course Poultry Health Online. That's just for the first five places only. So get your asses into gear, folks, if you're interested in that one. The course will reflect developments in poultry health and the changing areas of veterinary and technical expertise within it. It's aimed at vets, technical staff, managers from the poultry industry who wish to learn more about the nature, diagnosis and control of infectious diseases in poultry. The course is also suitable for non-specialist graduates who wish to gain a thorough knowledge of the poultry sector while working towards the postgraduate awards in agri-food. Once again, aftp.co.uk/podcast. Graham, now the most more perceptive amongst the listeners will have discerned that you are not, in fact, a native of Brussels. Whereabouts are you from in Scotland?
I'm a Fifer, Will.
Lovely Fife.
Grew up in Fife near St Andrews, but left there coming on for about 20 years now.
Yeah, okay.
So I have to go back every now and again to try and top my accent up.
You still, family still up there?
Family are all still there. Still in the same house, still in the same village. I try and go back as much as I can, but not as much as I would like. It's a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Any links to farming in your background?
There is one link. So my grandfather, actually, he's Polish, and they had a family farm in Poland before he and the rest of his family had to kind of flee when Poland was invaded. So the family farm is long gone there. But when he came to Scotland after being rescued by the British Army and brought to the UK to train to go back to liberate Poland. And then the war ended. He ended up in St Andrews or just outside St Andrews in a place called Boar Hills, where he basically managed a farm there. So that's
wow.
That's as close as I have to farming in my background.
That's really interesting. So did you meet him? He was around when you were born?
Yeah, he was. He died about, well, I must say, 10 years ago now.
Okay.
Absolutely fascinating guy.
You
always kind of realize once they leave all of the questions that you should have been asking them and all the things that you should have been trying to learn. So put me feel like I have half the story.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. So, not growing up on a farm then, but you did have a lot of links to food growing up.
Absolutely. I mean, food, anyone who knows me, food is my absolute passion. And it comes from the fact that, you know, when I was growing up, my mum, and she wasn't until very recently, a home economics teacher. I don't even know if home economics is still a thing they teach at school or not.
I'm not sure.
I have got sort of memories of making strange things like sort of sunshine Susie, which is this awful thing with a bit of toast and a slice of pineapple and a cherry and some ham. Dreadful. This is what kind of passed for food in Scottish high schools. I just used to love cooking with mum, and she was never, you know, the most exotic of cooks, but she would always make like the best kind of traditional roast or an amazing apple crumble, and I just love food. And it kind of grew from there. And so many of my memories from being a child are kind of linked to food and being together as a family and the smells. And it's just, I love it. It's my thing.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people listening will have similar memories, actually. Food, it just brings people together, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Remember, you know, afternoons, sitting in my grand kitchen in Glenrothes, and the whole family would be there because we all lived really nearby. Mm-hmm. And you know, my gran always cooked. She wasn't necessarily the best cook, but she, you know, memories of completely overcooked brisket that basically kind of flaked apart. And the only way you could eat it was by covering it in litres of gravy.
Yeah.
And cabbage that had been boiled for about a week before you arrived, but
yeah,
it wasn't the best meal, but it was the whole kind of it was everything that came with it. It was family, it was the laughter, it's just great. It brings you together.
Yeah. And did you used to try and do a bit of cooking yourself at an early age?
I tried relatively unsuccessfully to do a bit of cooking by myself at a young age. But my kind of passion for really doing it was when I got my first job working in a hotel. I was a waiter in a hotel restaurant, and I used to love just watching the chefs and then kind of going home. And I was like 16, so still relatively young compared to now. Mm-hmm. I'd try and recreate some of these things that they were making. To make my beans on toast look rather more presentable.
how do you make beans on toast look more presentable?
I'm not sure that you can. It's all about how you cut the bread, you know.
Okay. So tell us about your journey from Scotland to Brussels, because you studied politics at university, right?
I did. I, to be honest, never imagined that I would end up in Brussels. I'm kind of one of these people who's quite, I don't know about you, but I was always going through education, high school, university, really jealous of people who had a clear plan for their lives.
Yeah.
They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they could tell you, you know, within a year of leaving school, they were going to be working for this organization or doing this.
Yeah.
I never had that. I was always pretty opportunistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied politics in my last year of my politics degree, starting to think about what I wanted to do. How do I combine my passion for food, for example, with a love of politics? And at the time, the Ministry of Agriculture was advertising for people to go work for them, just generalists. And I started there. And I started, I had literally a kind of baptism of fire. So I think within about 2 or 3 weeks of me joining, foot and mouth disease hit. And it meant that for people who were willing to kind of come into the department, for want of a better term, kind of roll up their sleeves and get on with stuff, there was there were a lot of opportunities. And I got into animal health. And I loved the issue. And I loved the people that I was working with and the challenge. And I was able to work on things like, you know, trade, keeping markets open during foot and mouth disease, trying to get them open up again afterwards, and gradually found myself getting more involved in EU issues and going to committees in Brussels, which at the time, but it was so bizarre. These committees were held in rooms where you could still smoke. so you imagine these big kind of committees in 2004. Big committee rooms where it was filled with the 27 member states and people sitting puffing on cigarettes. It was, oh God, it was awful. but that was where all the big decisions were made, you know, where they sort of relatively unknown committee with experts from 27 member states making decisions on, you know, lifting foot and mouth disease restrictions or lifting BSE restrictions.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And got more and more involved. And eventually, after having worked for DEFRA until 2006, I was asked to come to Brussels and take up a post as agriculture attaché to UK agriculture attaché to the EU.
Okay.
So I kind of spent 4 years banging my fist on the table and trying to get people to listen to the UK.
Brussels is quite a unique place, isn't it? It's such a melting pot of people from all over Europe, all over the world. Did you like it there straight away? Did you really take to the city?
I should put a pretty large disclaimer on this and say, actually, I don't live in Brussels just now. I live in the UK and I come here to work every week. And Brussels is, it's a real secret city. So it's not like London where, you know, you go into the centre of London and it's exciting and there's an energy and you can do things and feel like anything's kind of possible. Brussels is really secret. So you have to, when you come here, you kind of have to get to know it, and you have to get to know its intricacies and where the best bars are and where the best restaurants are. And the people are just fantastic. You know, you meet people from such interesting backgrounds. And like I said, it's a melting pot. Everyone kind of comes together, and it's pretty easy for someone who speaks English as a native language, because so does everyone else speaks English as well. It's great.
Okay. And what kind of issues were you working on when you were agriculture attaché?
A load of different issues. So I was there for 4 years, and I worked on issues as diverse as banning the import of seal fur and cat and dog fur to electronic ID of sheep and goats when they were trying to bring that in after foot and mouth disease, animal welfare, veterinary medicines, more UK disease outbreaks, lots of different issues. And it was absolutely fascinating to kind of be right at the heart of policy making in Brussels and trying to get people to understand, you know, the particularities of the UK.
And what I mean, I guess a big part of your job is building relationships, dealing with people?
Absolutely. Certainly working in the UK representation, I worked in the European Commission after that, now working for the European Court Protection Association. It's all about relationships and understanding people and understanding where they're coming from.
Mm.
And so much of what will be, certainly the issues I'm involved in now, I mean, pesticides is a pretty visceral issue.
Mm.
There's a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
And unless you can understand people and understand where they're coming from and demonstrate some kind of empathy and understanding, it's very difficult to have sort of meaningful discussions, conversations, and try to find solutions that work for everyone.
Mm. Okay. And working in Brussels in the EU, in your notes you sent me for this interview, you said that the EU is hugely misunderstood in the UK. Can you, as someone who works there, expand on that a little bit?
I think, I talked about my granddad a bit earlier.
Yeah.
For me, I feel as well as one of the biggest benefits that the EU has brought is the fact that, you know, we have had peace in Europe for the longest period ever.
Yeah.
That for me is an emotional tie. And that's kind of been lost. But in terms of the way that people understand the EU, I think the EU, to a very large extent, I'm sure there's plenty of people who would admit this, isn't particularly good at explaining what it does, why it does it. And I've seen frequently, time and time again, either when I was working in the Commission or when I was working in the UK representation, national governments being able to take the good things that the EU has agreed to and represent them as, you know, big policy victories. So,
yeah.
You know, one good example is roaming. You know, very recently, you know, you see that there was a series of tweets from the UK government saying, we have done this. We have managed to. The UK government has, you know, done away with roaming. And actually, it's an EU decision to do away with roaming. But yet, when there are bad decisions, things that they don't like, we're able to kind of turn around and point the finger at Europe and say that you don't like it.
Mm.
I think the EU can do more to explain what it does and why it does it. I think successive governments in the UK had the opportunity to explain it better as well.
Yeah.
And didn't.
Yeah. Okay. So you, in 2010, you worked for the European Commission on Communication for a little bit.
I did.
And worked with some chefs in the UK. Back to food again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I worked in DG Sonti, which is a part of the commission that's responsible for health and food safety.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it comes back to, you know, what I was saying about the EU trying to explain what it does and why it does it. And we started a number of different initiatives to try and talk about the rules that the EU has in place to keep food safe and to make sure that the food that arrives on the table of Europe's 500 million consumers is safe.
Yeah.
And we thought one of the best ways to do that was to work with different chefs in different countries and get them to talk about, okay, what do they think about when they are cooking for their customers, what's important to them? How do they know that the food that they're putting on the plates of their customers is safe? And we also, and I know that's something that we talked about when we met in Brussels, but we did quite a lot to try and engage kids in the process as well. So we go to big national food fairs and some chefs would come and do, you know, a demo, and we would get kids along and get them to take part in it, because, you know, so much so much kind of, I guess, misinformation out there about food and its safety and about things like animal welfare. And we wanted kids to really, you know, hear and see themselves, and have something really concrete in front of them to help them understand the issues around food.
Yeah.
And it was great.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that these misconceptions and fear issues around food have become so big over the last 5-10 years? Do you think that as an industry, agricultural industry, we've not been necessarily very good at talking about what we do?
I think there's a number of different reasons. I mean, I think one is, I think it's becoming, in the age of, you know, social media, which is, you know, it has so many positives. Mm-hmm. The potential to share information is huge, but the potential to share misinformation is also huge. And mm-hmm. and I think we have this constant battle where it's easy to a 280 character tweet that you see that, you know, says something about, you know, your food not being safe, mm-hmm. than it is to actually delve into the issue, find out more about it, and to challenge some of these things. I think there certainly is more that we, as an industry, as the crop protection industry, can, should, and are trying to do to better explain the role of our industry, to better mm-hmm. explain exactly what pesticides are and why they exist. Because I think in the heat of the debate over the last, I mean, I've only worked in crop protection now for about 2 years, but I get the sense that, you know, something's been building for maybe the last 10 years. Somehow the utility and the fundamental need for the product has been lost. About the reasons behind it in the debate. Mm. You know, they're there because farmers need access to them. Farmers need access to a whole range of tools. Pesticides are one of those. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys don't want to be spending money on inputs that you don't need.
Absolutely not, no.
so, you know, it's about helping people understand pesticides, about helping people understand the impact of potentially losing them. Mm-hmm. And it's not to convince people that, you know, the pesticides are a panacea, far from it. It's just about saying, look, you know, these are discussions that, as society, you have to understand there are lots of different ways to produce food, and this is one of them. And just like every other way of producing food, there are costs and there are benefits to it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what I am really loving, and again, talking about the positive power of social media, is seeing so many people in the farming industry getting involved and becoming part of a conversation, and showing what they're doing, showing what you do on your farm, showing, you know, the challenges that you face, and really, you know, communicating, harnessing all of these great technologies that we have, and getting the message out there. It's so important.
Absolutely. All right then. So we've briefly mentioned the ECPA, European Crop Protection Agency, where you work now. Perhaps you better just explain what it actually is as an organisation.
Sure. So European Crop Protection Association is the European level trade association that represents the manufacturers of pesticides in Europe. So it's kind of like, I guess, I don't know what the NFU is to farmers. Mm-hmm. We represent all these companies, most of whom you and your listeners will have heard of, or in fact use their products. Mm-hmm. And our job is to try and make sure that the products, the innovations that our industry bring to market are able to, that your you as farmers are able to continue to have access to them.
Mm-hmm.
We have an office in Brussels. There's 18 of us working on a number of different issues from myself in public affairs. So that's our direct relations with the EU and its institutions, our communication work. So I talked a bit about what we're trying to do to better explain the role of pesticides. We have a campaign called With or Without, hashtag mm-hmm. With or Without. Encourage your listeners to check that out. And then we also have a part of the association that works on the regulation, so how that regulation works and advising our companies. And then lastly, a part of the association which works on stewardship. And stewardship is a significant commitment that we make as an association, but also as an industry, to make sure that the products, when they're put on the market, are used in the right way. So we have the Safe and Sustainable Use Initiative as an example, where we provide training to farmers, where we try and increase access to protective equipment, those kinds of things. So it's our sort of the social responsibility element of our industry.
Okay. And you said to me that this is the best job you've ever had. Why do you say that? What's so good about it? What are the best things about the job?
First part is obviously it connects directly with my passion for food. The second part is the people.
Uh-huh.
Not just the people I work directly with, but the people that I come into contact with on a daily basis, whether that is, getting to spend time talking to someone like you, Will, today, or as we were doing a couple of weeks ago, cooking in the kitchen in Brussels,
yeah.
Or being in the European Parliament, talking directly to an elected politician and trying to, it could be someone who is completely opposed to pesticides and the challenge of trying to kind of reach these people and to try and convince them of the necessity and of the importance of our industry, particularly if we're going to be addressing pretty major challenges like feeding a world population, a massive world population that's growing all the time. And I love it. It's a great industry. It's an innovative industry. It's an exciting industry. And I just love being part of trying to tell its story and improve its reputation.
Yeah. Okay. But the job also does have its downsides. You do get a bit of flack, don't you?
I get a pretty significant amount of flack. I'm not sure what my parents tell people I do, but it's no secret that our industry does not have the best reputation, I think there is an extent to which our industry has to recognize it and recognizes that we haven't always necessarily done things in the right way. We should have perhaps gone about doing things differently, communicating differently, doing more to communicate and talk about the benefits and convince people to move for the industry.
Mm-hmm.
There are huge challenges, and there are people that are not willing to be convinced or to even enter into a conversation where, we might allow you to try and convince them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people get a little bit angry to the extent that, after one particular interview I did on French TV last year around the issue of neonics, I got a death threat afterwards.
Okay.
I get a pretty constant stream of emails that I wouldn't want to read out on the show, Will. Every week or so, and it's part of the cost of being being out in the sort of public eye and putting myself out there and being willing to defend our industry and to do it passionately. And I do it unapologetically as well, because I believe in what I'm doing.
Mm.
But it's not easy when you're sitting on a Friday night trying to relax after a long week and talking to your kids and finding out about their week, and then you glance at your phone and someone wants you dead.
It's quite an understatement. I guess it just comes with the territory, but even so, it's still that's a pretty big thing to deal with, isn't it?
It is. I talked earlier about the strengths of, the costs and the benefits of social media.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you, I guess, makes it easy for you to get your message out, but also makes people feel like, they can throw whatever they want at you.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it easier for people to do that. The sort of the abuse and the criticism, I think that comes with the territory, and I accept that, there are people out there who disagree with me or disagree with the way our industry has done things, and that's okay. I don't expect everyone to agree with us. But sometimes I am still surprised by the real strength of feeling, the anger that comes through is incredible.
Mm.
But what we're doing is, I still kind of fundamentally believe in what we're doing as an industry, and I want to, I'm very happy to engage with all the people that disagree with me. Providing they want to engage with me, and I will debate the issue of pesticides with anyone. There are some people that are not willing to be convinced or even open to allowing you to start convincing them.
Yeah. On that then, I can't talk to you without mentioning glyphosate. Roundup, it's been all over the news, seems like, for months. And again, with the court case in the US over the last few weeks. Does that kind of dominate everything that's going on at the moment or not?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it dominates everything, but there's always every issue that we're dealing with, meeting that we might have with someone, there's always this kind of specter of glyphosate kind of hanging around. Even in the European Parliament at the moment, they set up a special committee to investigate or to look into the regulatory system for pesticides, and this was on the back of the glyphosate debate last year. So it's something that's it's still there, and I think there is. We're coming up to an election period in the European Parliament. I think it's going to stay on the agenda, and glyphosate only has a 5-year approval.
Mm-hmm.
So already companies are having to think about the renewal process.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's still an issue that's going to be with us for some time to come. As an industry association, we wouldn't ordinarily get involved with defending individual substances as such. So, but in the case of glyphosate, it's such an important substance, and is going to set so many dangerous precedent for our industry if it wasn't approved.
Mm-hmm.
That we did get involved in more hands-on in the debate and trying to defend it, because if there is let's be honest, there is no coincidence that they would necessarily choose a substance like glyphosate to target and try and have banned, because if you can have arguably the safest substance that has ever been put on the market, banned, then you can imagine how much easier it then becomes for people to question other substances. Luckily, it was approved, but only for a very short amount of time.
Yeah, and it the prospect of it being of it banned is really a terrifying one for farmers, especially if, you know, a lot of guys doing zero tillage now. You know, I don't know how they could possibly manage without it.
Absolutely not. And, you know, it was a fascinating debate to be involved in, because there are so many things about glyphosate, for example, that in a debate around pesticides seem completely counterintuitive. You know, you know, being able to use, I was sort of laughed out of rooms when I was saying to people who didn't want it approved, I was trying to convince them that, you know, there are environmental benefits to using this product. And they wouldn't even listen. The idea that you can reduce the amount of water you have to use, the idea that you reduce the damage to the soil. These are all things that people didn't necessarily want to hear. And certainly the impact on agriculture was something that was not even considered as part of the debate. Which was a tragedy.
Which is why we've got to all play our part in keep talking about what we did. Like you said earlier, with social media, isn't it? And there's, I mean, one of the best guys, actually, a guy called Jake Freestone, is on Twitter at #1FarmerJake, and he's a zero till farmer, and he does some fantastic videos and really explains it in a way that anybody can understand how important it is to his farming system. It's really important, isn't it?
Absolutely. Not many people know or even want to understand the intricacies of how pesticides are regulated here in Brussels, but the decisions on issues related to pesticides are taken by the Environment Committee in the European Parliament rather than the Agriculture Committee in the European Parliament. Which is why, you know, the debate takes on, I guess, a form that many farmers might not recognise, because they're not talking about the impact it's going to have on you guys.
Okay, so you mentioned the with or without hashtag with or without campaign earlier.
I did.
What is that? What's it all about? What is with or without? Explain that for us.
So, I guess I mentioned earlier, you know, the acknowledgement that our industry maybe hasn't always done what it should have in terms of explaining to people the benefits that pesticides bring. And when I started with ECPA, probably sort of 3 years ago this week, I think, we were looking at how we could do that better. And we, with the help of our members and some other organizations, we came up with a campaign called With or Without. And we called it With or Without because we didn't want it to be about going out and telling people, you know, pesticides are great, and trying to shove it down people's throats. We wanted to run a communication campaign that would show people that our industry was open and ready to kind of engage in a discussion about food production more generally, you know, and willing to acknowledge that, you know, yes, you can farm without pesticides, but there's a cost to doing that. There are lots of different ways that you can farm, and they all have the pluses and their minuses. And we just want to have a discussion about that and talk about the role that pesticides play, just to try and make people understand it better. And we did that because we worked in some countries as well, so it wasn't just based in Brussels. I think for the UK, we focused on The potential loss in some crops, like I think onions is one of them, where if you don't have access to the substances that are really needed, then you lose immediately 50% of your yield. Mm-hmm. We looked at lots of other crops as well. But it's just about showing people the impact, so making that a consideration. And it's been a really great campaign because it has engaged people. I said earlier about people, you know, getting anger and vitriol from people. We still get plenty of that, but we also get people who now positively engage with us on social media and ask questions and have a discussion. And that for us is a great development. And we want to see more of that. And it's a campaign that we've also worked with a lot of farmers. We started out actually with Tom Bradshaw, a UK farmer, a couple of years ago. He really supported us when we started driving the campaign. There's a great video on our campaign site showing Tom on his farm. He came to an event in Brussels and spoke, where you know a lot of people in Brussels said it was absolutely fantastic to have a real person in a Brussels debate. So he was, you know, someone who could really talk about what life is like on a farm, not just someone who's talking from a position paper that's been prepared for them.
Yeah, Tom's an excellent communicator, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. He's fantastic. And then we moved on to working with fantastic people like you, Will.
onto Let's Cook then. Oh, that's what they call a segue. Yeah. That's what they call a segue in the podcasting mood.
Completely unplanned. Can you imagine? How did we get onto this subject?
Yeah, how did that come about then? # Let's Cook.
Let's Cook. Well, it was, again, you know, I come at my best when I can combine my professional and personal passions. I think we all are.
Yeah.
And again, it's coming back to, you know, how about communicating and making the subject engaging. And we came up with this idea. I think the video's out there now. I'm sure you've been tweeting on it. Will, I've been tweeting on it. I'm sure you've got links up on your Rock and Roll Farming site.
Yeah.
The idea was two people in a Brussels kitchen, cooking. So using ingredients. I mean, when we spoke, Will, and when you came to cook with us, so we looked at barley and some of the other products that you grow, and have a discussion about food and food production and what it takes to, I mean, with you as a farmer, Will, it was about, you know, knowing what it takes to actually put that food onto people's plates, because people don't realize. I think people have lost touch with where their food has come from, and we want to reestablish that connection. And we want, again, you know, to show people that as an industry we're open, and we want to engage in a debate. We're not hiding away from the issues that are there. We recognise they're there, and we want to do it in a way that's, you know, accessible to people. And I think food is, you know, I think when we started off talking about food is something that brings people together.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that after doing this, the first episode with you, which, you know, thanks so much for coming in and doing it with us, that other people will see it and they will also want to come on and debate the issues. You know, I'm hoping that we'll get someone who, we had a really nice conversation, but I'm hoping that someone who doesn't agree with me, will come on and we can cook and we can talk and we can show people, you know, the full range of the debate. And it's about talking, because the only way we're going to find solutions for agriculture, for the future of food production, is to increase everyone's understanding of where everyone's coming from.
And yeah,
it's only by talking that you'll find those solutions.
Yeah, I mean, it was that aspect of it really appealed to me and why I was keen to get involved, because, you know, obviously the stuff I do on social media and with a podcast, I'm always keen for, if anyone's got any questions, just fire them at me and I'll always try and answer as best as I can. But the Let's Cook thing I thought was great, because I've long felt that if you asked 100 people in the street what's the first thing you think of when you say the word food, I think a lot of them would say supermarket or celebrity chef before they would say farmers. Yeah. And I think that's something we need to work on and try and sort of reconnect that food with farmers in people's minds. And I thought that Let's Cook is a really good way of doing that.
Yeah, we're you know, it's gone out now. I think it's been out for about a week, and we've had a really positive response to it. And like I said, hugely thankful to you for coming on and being part of the pilot episode. But we need, you know, you're a great advocate for your industry, Will, and we need more people like you to be out, you know, talking about the issues and just engaging people and be willing to answer questions. But I think it's when we shy away from answering the questions that people get skeptical and people get worried. The more that we can answer questions, it increases people's confidence and increases people's confidence in the food that they eat. It's a great thing.
Absolutely. So we were then cooking together in the kitchen, and I wasn't really doing much cooking, because it's you who's the master chef. You got to the master chef quarterfinals, and before we came to Brussels, I had a little Google stalk of you because I knew I was going to be cooking with you. And when I found out that you were MasterChef quarterfinalist, I nearly fell off the chair. I said to my wife, Sarah, Christ, this is who I'm going to be cooking with. I'm going to be miles out of my depth. How did that come about?
You were a good cook, Will. You managed, you managed to chop some stuff up, and food poisoning. So, you know, it's success in my book.
Yeah.
How did I end up on MasterChef? I don't know. Would I do it again? No, but it was an amazing experience. It really was. I applied twice. They have the most incredible application process. You have to fill out about 10 A4 pages of stuff about, you know, what,
okay,
why you love food and what your favorite dish is. I applied 1 year and didn't get on. I don't think I even heard anything from them. And then a year after, I tried again, and lo and behold, after a couple of kind of auditions and screen tests, they asked me to go be part of the show, which was just completely surreal. You know, for someone who has, I remember watching, I was a bit of a geeky kid. I remember sitting in my bedroom on a Sunday afternoon playing with my Lego and watching Lloyd Grossman on MasterChef with a red kitchen and the blue kitchen, and cogitating and digesting and whatever it was he did.
Yeah,
and I loved watching it, and I'd always kind of wanted to be on it, and it was just bizarre to be there in that kitchen, having seen it on TV so many times.
Yeah,
standing there, kind of waiting for John and Greg to appear. Weird experience, but a really good one. At least really good until you get kicked off. That bit's not so good.
Yeah, it must. I mean, was it? What's it like cooking? Did you feel a lot of pressure cooking meals with everything going on and everyone watching you and against the clock? And did you feel like you really got to perform? And
God, yeah, there's so much pressure. There's pressure cooking to time anyway. But when you're cooking to time and you've got it all kind of planned out in your mind what you need to do, and then when you least expect it, kind of John or Greg appear and start asking you questions about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you start to feel like everything's going wrong. And then sort of that, there was that kind of in the kitchen. And then one of the rounds, I had to go to a hotel kitchen. It was in the kitchen of the Meridian in Piccadilly on a lunchtime service. And down in the basement of the hotel and cooking in a real-life kitchen was just terrifying. I was stuck in front of a grill for about 5 hours. I think I lost about 5 stone in weight just from sweat.
Yeah.
Cooking, I think there was about 55, 60 people in for lunch, and 45 of those ordered steak.
Yeah.
Cooking 45 steaks to order when you've never been in that situation before was hairy. Only one got sent back, so that wasn't so bad.
No, I must have been there. Were you gutted when you got kicked off, or had you kind of had enough by then?
Oh God, I was absolutely gutted. I made such a mess of the last dish I did. So I overcooked some duck. I undercooked the beetroot fondant. I think it was still practically raw. And then didn't reduce my red wine sauce enough. So I basically was just pouring hot red wine over the top of overcooked duck and undercooked beetroot. I would have kicked me off. You always think that you can kind of go further and get there. But that
is, yeah.
Yeah. My moment was gone.
Yeah. Okay. So despite being a huge food lover and a MasterChef quarterfinal and all those things, you are what we'd call in farming a poor doer. You don't carry much weight. How do you manage that?
That's brilliant. I've never heard that before.
if farmers will be laughing, they'll know exactly what I mean. A poor doer.
I'm gonna have to go Google that one. How do I manage it? Well, one, I managed to keep it in check by having a relatively stressful job.
Yeah.
But on top of that, I spend a lot of time doing ridiculous things like marathons and triathlons and training for Ironmans and a lot of stuff that people think I'm a bit crazy for doing. But
How did that all start?
I love it. At school I was never sporty. I played golf. I was good at golf, and I had dreams of becoming a professional golfer, but I was never, ever sporty. At some point, my love of food and my metabolism weren't really matching up. At least it was increasingly obvious to me that my love of food and my metabolism weren't matching up. So I realized I had to do a bit of exercise. So I started doing a bit of running, started going to the gym, nothing too serious. And then my kids arrived. And I don't know, you've got kids, Will, and I don't know, having kids affects everyone in very different ways. But for me, I think, oh my God, you know what? I need to be able to run around with these people.
Yeah.
I need to have that boundless energy.
Yeah.
And I want to be around forever to make sure that, you know, I'm always here, and I need to stay fit and healthy, and I need to kind of show that as an example to them.
Yeah.
And I got into doing more and more running, and ended up sort of running marathons, and got a bit bored of just running marathons and decided I was going to do triathlons. And the great thing is now that the kids are a bit older, they're starting to do it with me as well.
So, that's fair. That's brilliant.
I love it.
Yeah.
And my wife will tell you I get really grumpy if I don't do it. That's the two things. I either get really hungry and grumpy, or if I don't get to do exercise, I get grumpy.
Yeah.
So at some point in the weekend, if I'm looking a bit grumpy, she says, why don't you just go and have a run?
Yeah.
And get out your system.
It's quite, I'm quite interested that you said about your kids there and wanting to sort of set an example for them, because that's actually how I how I kind of got into running as well. And that's why I sort of forced myself outside on dark nights, really, to, well, not only to clear my head and to keep fit, but it is very much to try and to set a good example to them.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah. It's important. We just come back from holiday. And I was saying, I've gotten to triathlon. I'm trying to get the kids into it now as well. And we were up in the French Alps, and they did this just fantastic triathlon. It was the first one they'd done. Put the little triathlon gear on, and along with about, you know, like 300 other kids, they just did it, and it was great.
Wow.
It's so good for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And you are going to try... I couldn't believe this. You're going to try and break 3 hours for a marathon soon. Now, I've done my best time is 3 hours 42 minutes. So I couldn't. I'm blown away by this.
Yeah, it's public now, Will. You're putting pressure on me. You know, this is always like an unsaid personal goal that I didn't have to admit to anyone. Now I'm going to have to actually do it.
Yeah, well, if that helps you beat it, you can buy me a pint.
All right, I'll buy you more than that if I'm anxious to do it. It's the magic number, right?
But you
want to break three.
Definitely.
I came so close in Manchester this year. I got 3 hours and agonizingly 47 seconds.
Oh, no.
So I'm hoping it won't be too difficult to shave off 47 seconds, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, best of luck. All right,
yeah, the promise of that beer might help me.
Yeah, well, there's nothing like that first beer after you've crossed the marathon line, is it?
Oh, yeah.
So, right then, we will end this on the five quick hard-hitting questions, if you're ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, what is your all-time favourite song?
Your Song by Elton John.
Oh, that's a romantic choice. That's lovely.
Yeah, no comparison.
Okay, if time wasn't an issue and you had forever to master a particular talent or skill, what would it be?
Oh, God, that one is difficult because I would spend all my time doing triathlon and getting better at that. But my biggest regret in life is that I can't play the piano.
Yeah.
And I started when I was a kid, and at some point I gave up. So I think that's what I would do. I would play piano.
Yeah, I think a lot of people say piano for that. I think that'd probably be my choice as well.
Yeah.
Okay. As we've established, you are a food lover. If you were on death row for committing an appropriately heinous crime, what would you choose for your final meal? What would you have for your final three-course meal?
So I guess that I'm going to ask a question to your question. So am I confined to the jail to have the meal, or am I allowed to go out for the day?
Oh, I think we can let you out under heavy security.
because it's such a difficult question to answer, but I'm not sure I actually have a favourite meal.
Okay.
I have, because for me, the meal is, it's about the food, but it's also about the experience.
Yeah, right.
So,
okay.
So my answer on that basis is the best meal I've ever had, and the one that I'd want to repeat, was on Vashon Island, which is on Puget Sound, so near Seattle.
Yeah.
We were there in the morning on the beach. We dug for clams. And then in the evening, we cooked them with butter and garlic and a crusty bread and sat on the beach with gorgeous, cold, crisp white wine and watched the sun go down.
Wow.
That would be the perfect meal.
That would take some beating. All right. If you could travel back in time and have a conversation with your 16-year-old self, what would you say to him?
Oh, God. There is nothing you can't achieve.
Yeah.
Don't let anyone tell you that there is something you can't achieve. You can do whatever you want, whatever you set your mind to.
Solid advice. Okay, then. And lastly, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in the agricultural industry in some way to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
Well, apart from you, obviously, Will, and Anna Jones, who you had on your show, I think,
yeah,
a few weeks ago now.
Yeah.
The other person I'd say is, and this is actually someone from my industry, his name is Adrian Perry. He was, until recently, the head of research and development at Bayer Crop Science.
Yeah.
He's now the AgTech ambassador. And if you follow him on Twitter, he has such an amazing passion for innovation, for engaging young people, and, you know, talking about what the future of agriculture can bring. And he brings it alive and talks about, you know, the great new innovations that our companies are developing, or whether it's digital ag or precision ag, or how we face the challenges of feeding growing world population. He's a really great guy to follow. If you can get over the fact that he supports Arsenal. Almost every third or fourth tweet maybe is something about Arsenal.
So
if you overlook that, he's a great guy to follow.
Okay. Graham, it's been fantastic to speak to you again. I really enjoyed it.
And you. You're going to come back and cook again sometime.
I will do. And yeah, thank you for taking the time. I'm sure you've got an early start tomorrow, so I do appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
And hopefully catch up with you again soon.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Will.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and see you next time. If you're feeling generous, please give this episode a share or retweet on social media. And if you feel like leaving the podcast a review on iTunes, that is always a big help. The podcast has now been downloaded in 81 different countries, would you believe? So I'm giving a shout out to one every week. And this time it is the Republic of Ireland, second highest number of downloads over there. So a big hello to everyone listening in the Emerald Isle. I've been Will Owens, this has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.